Now, moving into our second week in this series, Neighboring, we were introduced last week to this idea of neighboring, what it means to be a neighbor, why that's even an important conversation for us to have, why that's something we need to dig into and think about and see what it does to us and stirs up in us and changes us and makes us into different people. Why is that even important? It's interesting, as we talk about being neighbors, it's not just something that we're talking about here in a setting like this, in sort of the church world. It's actually something that people all around are thinking about. It matters to people who our neighbors are and what we do as we engage with the people around us. I was reminded of a section of a book that I read a few years back called The Art of Neighboring. And at the beginning of this book, a pastor who was writing this book introduced the topic of his book, Neighboring, with this little story about a group of pastors who pulled their mayor. They lived out in the Denver area. They pulled their mayor in and said, we're pastors. We want to make an impact in our community. What are some of the needs you see? What are some of the ways that we could step up and really make a difference? As the dialogue started, they had conversation back and forth about all sorts of different needs, probably not all that different from what we see here. You know, neglect of children, people being marginalized for different reasons, people facing addictions, homelessness, poverty, sort of these big issues that seem to always stare us right in the face, whatever communities we live in. But there was a moment where the conversation started to change a little bit. And as they pressed into the mayor and said, what can we do? Where's the real need? He responded with this. The majority of the issues that our community is facing would be eliminated or drastically reduced if we just figure out a way to become a community of great neighbors. And he went on to explain what he meant by that. He said, often when people identify a problem, they come to civic officials and say something like, this is becoming a serious issue and you should start a program to address it. The mayor shared candidly that in his opinion, government programs aren't always the most effective way to address social issues. He went on to say that relationships, this is the mayor speaking, are more effective than programs because they're organic and ongoing. The idea is that when neighbors are in relationship with one another, the elderly shut-in gets cared for by the person next door. The at-risk kid gets mentored by a dad who lives on the block, and so on, and so on. And so they continued the conversation a little bit further and thanked the mayor, and he left. And as the group of pastors debriefed this conversation, one of them reflected in this way. Am I the only one here who's a little embarrassed? I mean, we're here asking the mayor how we can best serve the city, and he basically tells us that it would be great if we could just get our people to obey the second half of the Great Commandment. And so here we are, looking at that very same issue. What does it mean to be people of Center Point Church who are living in such a way that we make that kind of impact in the places where we live and where we work and where we play? As we follow out that calling to be neighbors, to love our neighbors as ourselves. When we were introduced or reintroduced for some of us to that teaching of Jesus, the parable he told as he was asked that very question. Well, who is our neighbor? What does it mean? When you say love God and you say love your neighbor as yourself, I mean, flesh that out a little bit for me, Jesus. What does that really mean? And Jesus goes on to tell one of the most famous stories, one of the most famous parables of his teachings, the story of the Good Samaritan. So we won't rehash every single verse of that, but just to kind of bring us all back up to speed, you remember the story starts with someone traveling on a road from Jerusalem to Jericho. They're attacked in the midst of that by some robbers on the way, and they beat this traveler and leave him on the side of the road. And some other people who come along, a couple of religious leaders make their way by, people of the day who would have been seen as the most righteous, walk by, and we watch as they kind of sidestep and walk on the other side of the road and continue on their journey. And Jesus then goes on in a surprising fashion to explain the person who actually stops and does the neighboring thing as someone that the people listening to the story would have least suspected. It was surprising, it was shocking that this Samaritan who saw this trouble, the Samaritans and Jews didn't get along all that well. And so when this Samaritan comes over and he, as we talked about last week, we talked about what it means to notice, what it means to be neighbors, people who, where we live, where we work, where we play, where we notice what's happening around us. And in some way we're stirred by that. As a marker of the people of God that we notice in the places where we live, where we work, where we play, what's happening in the people's lives around us. We talked about this idea that rehumanizes the people around us. They're not just a problem or an issue to walk on the other side of the road and avoid. They become people that we notice and we engage with. And as the story goes on, we see that the Samaritan doesn't just notice and stop by, take a picture and go to Facebook and open up a new page about help the traveler who's hurting on the side of the road and hope that he gets lots of clicks and likes and people who donate. No, he actually engages. He responds in some way. And so this morning we take this conversation to that level of response, of serving. Neighboring is serving. Responding to those things that we are noticing in the lives of people around us. As we continue to see them, not just as problems and issues to solve, but as we see them as people that God has created and loves and desires the best for them, just like he does for us. And so we're challenged by this idea of serving, responding to the needs that we notice, where we live, where we work, and where we play. Now, when we think of serving, there's probably sort of images that come to mind of people who represent that to you. When you think of people who live lives of service, who dedicate themselves selflessly to others, there's probably some visuals that come to mind. I wouldn't be surprised if this is one of them, right? Mother Teresa. Mother Teresa is like the epitome of someone who lived sacrificially, selflessly, humbly, giving herself away to meet the needs of others. She responded when she noticed what was happening in her world. And she met people's needs in some really significant ways. And so her story is one that inspires us and drives us. But I think sometimes when we only think of serving in these sort of big dramatic strokes and broad strokes of this picture of what serving looks like, we get this ideal that we think, well, I could never live up to that. I mean, I can't be Mother Teresa. And so it kind of, in some ways, begins to excuse us. And we can kind of play games with that. We think, well, that's just for the few, really, when we think about what it means to serve. That's not for all of us. That's for the people we pay to do it. That's for the people who have something inside of them that's different from me that makes them that way, that they can go and do that. However, we begin to justify that in our own minds, we make this distinction that we can excuse ourselves from serving in those ways. But I would bet that if I were to ask you, and I'm going to ask you to do this actually for a moment, think in your own life, in your own experience, not people distant way out there, pictures that you see on the news or read about in books, but actually practically in your own life. Where have you experienced serving? When I say, who is a person that represents serving to you? Because you've experienced it. Think about that for a moment. And then I'm going to ask you, this is the engaging part of our time together this morning. You're going to actually share this with the person next to you. So this is going to be a 60-second drill. So you got to think quick. I'm giving you a little prep time. And I want you to talk just briefly. Just mention who that person is, why it is that they come to your mind in like a sentence or two. Right? Just get that picture in your mind, then share with the person. If you're introverted like me, my wife said, I'm not introverted. She said she's not introverted, but she still doesn't like it when I do this. But I'm sorry. I'm standing here. You have to listen to me do this. And I'm introverted, so I'm the one who sits there like this when other people ask me to do it. But I'm here, so I can ask you to do it and feel good about it. But who comes to your mind and why? All right, so 60 seconds. Think about it for a moment and then share with the person next to you or just think about it on your own. Ready? Go. All right, about 30 seconds. We're halfway there. So if you've been dominating the conversation, leave some room for someone else. All right. So when I asked you to think about that person, when I asked you to think about why you chose them, I didn't see anybody get up angrily and like walk out the back door. Right? I mean, there's something about when we think about those people who have served us, who have given of themselves to us, that there's something that stirs inside of us when we think about those people. It's impacting. When we think about the ways that people have given of themselves to us, even in maybe little ways. When I think about that question, I think of my grandparents, Ruth and Gilbert Bankson. Now, they're here with, this was several years ago. I'm not actually even in this picture. This was probably back in the mid-90s. My grandfather has since passed away. My grandmother is still alive. She's in her 90s. She's living in assisted living home down just in Massachusetts near my parents. But when I think of people who serve, who I got to experience what it means to serve, to see them serve, and what that really means, I think of my grandparents. Now, my grandmother was the host of all hosts. Part of that was because my grandfather just kept inviting people that he would meet back to the house, and she kind of had to learn how to do that. But really, I think there was something in her heart that desired to serve and to create an environment, an atmosphere that welcomed people in, that created a space around the table where there was always an extra seat where someone could be invited in, who maybe didn't have a home or didn't have a meal or didn't have a group that they belonged to. So every Thanksgiving, every Christmas, there tended to be extra people around the table that I didn't necessarily recognize. Because they were being served generously and given of sacrificially by my grandparents. My grandfather was the type of guy where I don't know how he would figure this out, but I remember more than one story where he'd be out, I don't know where, and he would just somehow find people who needed things. A single mom who's raising a baby who needed diapers or milk. And somehow he found a way to be able to meet that need. Where he worked, he was the guy, by the time he was had been in construction for a long time, he was kind of the super. He was overseeing everything. But his workers came in to talk to him, not just about what the job that was going on there was supposed to look like, but about what was happening in their lives. Because they knew he would listen, and he would care, and he would respond in some way. Whether it was just with an encouraging word or providing something that they couldn't provide for themselves. I think of my neighbor, Dave Burnham, and his wife, Martha. Now, Dave likes to snowblow every snowstorm. I think some of it's because he really enjoys it. But I think it's also because he has a heart for the neighborhood that I learned about when I moved into this neighborhood 12 years ago. He's now probably lived in the neighborhood for over 40 years. I kind of look at him and his wife as the matriarch and patriarch of the neighborhood. They kind of oversee everything that happens. But when there's a need, when there's a concern, Martha's going to send a card every birthday. She's going to come over with cookies. Dave's going to be there to help out. He's in his 70s now. He's going to be out there every 3 inches of snow blowing, not only at the end of everybody's driveway, but also the sides of the street, just because the snow plows just never quite get it wide enough. But it comes because he's someone who serves. That's inspiring. As I look at those little acts, there's something that stirs inside of us. But I think we also recognize that when we are inspired by these stories of service, we also know that there are stories that don't necessarily inspire us of service. For instance, what if I were to tell you that my neighbor Dave actually only snow blows the end of our driveways because someone else is paying him to do it? That kind of diminishes a little bit of it. Doesn't change the fact that I really love that he's doing it. But the act of service that I once thought was there sort of changes in my mind. Because now I see that he wasn't motivated just out of a concern for me, but there's this question that comes into play. Well, why is he really doing this? Now, Dave isn't doing that. There's no one funding his snowblowing addiction. But there is this question that comes into play with motives and attitudes as we serve seem to be fairly significant. If we examine our own lives, we probably could be a little bit more honest about ourselves if we were to say that there are times where we serve other people for motives that aren't all that great or pure. There are ways to do acts of service that are actually self-serving. I can look to everyone else like I'm doing something for their benefit. But when I do it because I'm self-serving, I'm doing it because I'm motivated by what I'm going to get in return from this, whether that's some sense of affirmation from them, some sense of payment, some way that I can call this back out later on and get something from them down the road, some sense of sort of self-gratification and fulfillment that I get in doing these things, whatever that might be. We can turn service and serving into something that's not all that attractive when it's discovered. There are other motives that can come into play. We could be principle-driven people. We can just serve because, boy, we know we're supposed to do it. And so we build in the habits, we build in the walls, we build in the boundaries, and we just know that that's what we're supposed to do. And so the principle drives us. There can be this sense that if we just serve enough, we'll be free from some guilt that's weighing us down. I just need to do a little bit more to free myself from this. I can just kind of earn my freedom from this guilt by serving and doing more. And so we carry the weight of that kind of serving. There can even be love-induced service that says, I'm going to serve the people that I love, and that's good. But when our only motive and attitude in serving is that we say, well, I'm just going to serve these people over here because they love me and I love them, then we tend to forget about the opportunities to serve the other, the people who are outside of that ring. There's fear-induced serving, which my kids probably say they have some experience in. You will do this, or else. But we experience these things in different ways. And so when we dig down deep inside, we begin to recognize that when we look at the story of the Good Samaritan, I'm not so sure I would have been as actively engaged as he was. When we see what he actually did, how he actually responded in the middle of that culture and context that had so many obstacles and barriers in the way for him to do that act of service, there was something deeper driving him. Now, this wasn't necessarily the point that Jesus was making necessarily right in that message, but we see this idea of what it means to not just do acts of service, but what it actually means to be a servant in the teachings of Jesus. And in the life of Jesus. Because you can do acts of service without being a servant for all sorts of motives and reasons. But you can't be a servant and not serve other people. When being a servant is your identity, it changes your entire perspective on how you engage with the world around you. Jesus gives us some insight into this in another place where he was teaching his disciples. His disciples had been arguing about who was going to be first, who was going to be greatest in Jesus' kingdom. They had this picture in their mind of what it was supposed to look like. And because they were closest to Jesus, they began to think through the lens of self-serving. They said, all right, we're doing all these good things for a lot of people. What am I going to get out of it, Jesus? A couple of them ask, can we sit at your right and your left in your kingdom? You're the king, but we want to be right there. And Jesus goes in to their hearts in this and shows two pathways of living. Mark chapter 10, verses 42 through 45. You can open there if you have your Bibles, or you can follow along on the screen as well as we take a look at what Jesus has to say here. Because there's something about our attitudes and our motives while we are serving that shapes our hearts in a particular direction. And so Jesus presents these two pathways. One they were very familiar with because it was the world that they were living in. Mark chapter 10, verse 42 and following. Jesus called them together, his disciples. And he said, you know, that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. So he's sharing this world, that he's pointing out this world that they live in. That the rulers of that day, that were not a part of the kingdom that Jesus was talking about, that were a part of this other kingdom, this worldly kingdom, the people who were all around them, who would have had positions of authority and power, because it had been appointed to them, they had inherited it, or they had built up enough wealth to gain that power. So look at how they lead. Look at their idea of greatness. And he goes on from there. In verse 43, he says, "But not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. And whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many." Two pathways. Two extremes on the end of the spectrum. On one end of the spectrum, we see self-service. Doing everything that you can with all the power that you can grasp onto to take advantage of every situation to serve yourself, to build your own kingdom that centers around you and is driven by that. So look at the people around. They're accumulating wealth. They're accumulating power. They're doing all these things to put themselves in a status, in a position where they can then lord it over. They can take advantage of the people underneath them in order to build themselves up further. I don't think it's all that different from the world that we live in today either. Because it's not just them out there. It's not this idea that just exists in other places, in other parts of the world. No, it exists right inside of us. Each of us struggle in some way with this idea of serving only ourselves in this world. And so on this pathway of building a self-serving personal kingdom, achievement and greatness are equated, as he says, with position and with power. Power is assumed. It's assumed in that world that you would use your power for whatever purpose would gain you the most benefit. That position, whatever position you're given in authority over others, would be a right to take advantage of other people. That's the right that people in positions of authority are assumed to have. That your identity would be derived from what you're able to do. If I can just do a little bit more, if I can just do these things, if I can just gain a little bit more, then I'll have my identity as one of greatness. And humility and sacrifice, we talk about those things as ideals that we embrace, and yet rarely are they actually embraced as a lifestyle. But Jesus says there's a different way. You see, that's shaping your heart. That's shaping who you're becoming. When you see yourself in this lens, you're shaping not only the actions you take, but you're shaping who you're actually becoming. You may have experienced that and seen it in your own life when you start sort of in that circle and you spiral into that world of me at the center. It drives us deeper and deeper. Or becomes harder and harder to see anything outside of what is happening in my own world and how it's going to impact me. And so we use manipulation and subversive techniques to get what we want in our families and relationships with other people in our neighborhoods, in our workplaces. We look at other people and we wait for them to do something for us. We make conversations, interactions with other people all about us and our own agenda. We assume that people who don't agree with us aren't really worth our time. And so we do build our own kingdoms that way with us in the middle. But Jesus says there's a different way. He says in his kingdom, in his way of living, when we give ourselves to him and to that very thing, we start to see the world very differently. We start to see our lives and our place in it very differently. He says, on the other end of the spectrum, greatness isn't about position and power. Greatness is equated with servanthood. being a servant. Power is assumed not to be used for your own benefit, but to give advantage to others. What you've been given in power, Jesus says, is for you to use to give others advantages and to benefit them. And where position is used, or your identity, is derived from who you are, who he calls you to be, who he tells you you are. You're a servant. Loving the Lord your God. Loving your neighbor as yourself. Noticing what's happening as he's working in the world around us, and then responding and being a part of it as we serve the people around us. And humility and sacrifice are embraced not only as ideals, but as a lifestyle, an expectation for all who follow after Jesus to strive after. There have been others who have talked about this, who call it the pathway of downward mobility. In our world, we like to think about the possibility of moving up and what that holds for us. But in actuality, the pathway of servanthood that Jesus calls us to brings us lower. How low? Well, Jesus says, let me show you how low. It means full servanthood with an entire life being given for the sake of another. He says, even as great as the Son of Man, the Son of God, as great as I am not exempt from this either. In fact, I will demonstrate and live out to the fullest what this means. And so there are small steps that we can take in that direction. Mother Teresa is famous for saying that we can do no great things, only small things with great love. And so there's something to that idea. That maybe for us, a step into servanthood is merely a step of asking a question and actually listening to the person's response. Engaging in their story and what's happening in their lives and paying attention and growing an awareness of what God might be stirring and doing in them. Not assuming that you have the answers, that you have to fix everything, but engaging and listening. Maybe it's making a meal for a neighbor. Maybe it's inviting them over for a meal, opening up your home, showing hospitality. Maybe it's spending time with your kids in your home, doing what they want to do, sacrificing something of your own time and desires for them. Maybe it's not dominating a conversation with your agenda and with your story. There are small steps we can take in this. And we find that as we take small steps into the way that God is calling us to live, into his kingdom, into Jesus' kingdom, as we experience that, it drives us deeper. And it begins to shape our hearts. As we take those small steps into his kingdom, we begin to experience and know what his kingdom, what his way, what his world that he's recreating is all about. And what he's invited us into to participate in. And so we become recipients of that. God serves us so that we can then serve others. So as we receive that blessing from him, we have the opportunity to put ourselves lower and to serve the world around us where he's placed us and called us. And those obstacles will still stand in the way for us. Those obstacles that say, you're not getting any return on this investment. Look how long you've been serving these other people. What have they ever done for you? We remember that that's not the servanthood that Jesus calls us into. And sure, we'll have mixed motivations along the way. We'll still have times where we serve because it's the principle that we follow. We'll still have times where we recognize that there's guilt-induced serving that's happening. There'll still be times where we recognize that our serving is not necessarily motivated in the purest sense as a response to God's love to us. But it's what we do in those moments that continues to shape and to mold our hearts. And so we reflect. As we serve, we reflect that action. We come back around and we say, who am I in this? Honestly, God, show me, who am I becoming? Am I becoming more a servant of your kingdom and your way? Or am I somehow manipulating this into being about me? And we repent of that and we move in the direction that he would have us go. It's a journey, not a giant leap. But as we experience that kingdom, as we experience Jesus in all of this, there's something powerful that happens. There's a couple of parables that Jesus told us about what it means to experience his kingdom and the response that creates in us. They're very brief, just a few verses where he explains how this works. Because we think about, how do I become a servant who's not just motivated by guilt, who's not just motivated by fear, who's not just motivated by principle, but actually truly desires to be in my heart a servant and a part of what God is doing in the world. That would drive me. How do I become that? I can't inspire you enough right here on my own. You can't give enough effort to make that happen on your own. God does that in us as we take steps towards him. And Jesus described it this way. He says, the kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field. When a man found it, he hid it again, and then in his joy went and sold all he had and bought that field. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. When he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything he had and bought it. You know how we become servants? We experience and discover the kingdom for ourselves. We discover who Jesus is. We dig deeper into who he is. We look and we see what his kingdom is that's unfolding in the world all around us and what he's doing to restore and redeem and make new what's broken. And we're drawn into that. Jesus says, you can't actually make fruit on your own if you're a vine that's disconnected, or if you're a branch that's disconnected from the vine. And likewise, for us as followers of Jesus, unless we are engaged and connected and discovering who he is, as he pours himself into us with that great love, then we'll never bear the fruit of servanthood in our own lives. And so that's the pathway of character-shaping servanthood that God calls us into. We see the big vision, the big picture of his kingdom and what that looks like. And yes, it inspires us and it draws us in. But the means of getting there is not by our own effort, but through the pathway that Jesus has laid for us. As we abide in him, as we discover and experience who he is, we're driven deeper to say, I'm going to sell all I have. I am going to be all out servant. I'm going to give everything I have to be able to give my life towards this greater thing. And when we talk about that greater thing, we sometimes get mixed up and confused about what that means. When we talk about serving, sometimes we think in our minds that when we talk about serving, that means what happens here in this building. Yeah, I serve at Center Point Church. But in actuality, when we talk about the life of a servant, we're talking about a life that extends beyond what happens here. Because it can be overwhelming in our world to start looking at things and to feel like we're just kind of here, stuck in the corner as those who are trying to live out what it means to be God's people, to live as servants. I was given a visual of this in a book that I recently read called Imagine Church by a man named Neil Hudson. I'm going to read a segment from that book and show you a visual on the screen here. For too long, we've emphasized a false picture of the church's current and potential activity of serving. For example, many people see the church represented by the red dots in the diagram below, or right here on the left. They think of the church as in the corner, in the ghetto, irrelevant, under siege, struggling to make connections with the wider society, working hard to reach people, investing much time, effort, and resources in mission work, but often failing to make any real impact. But most of the people of God, most of the time, are not in the corner. Most of the time, the people of God are scattered out in the world, connecting to scores of people in an average week, connecting with work colleagues, family members, neighbors, and friends. The reality is more like the image on the right. If we let this simple fact shape our disciple-making, this would result in the people of God living lives of mission and service, commissioned into all sorts of wonderful places that ministers of the gathered church would find frustratingly inaccessible. God is building his kingdom in our world, and he's called us as his people to build that. Not as we build an organization, not as we build up a church here, but as we live as his servants in the kingdom that he's building to transform and recreate and redeem this entire world, where you live, where you work, and where you play. This is the vision that God has given to us to be his servants. And what could be greater than to be a part of transforming the entire world as God is doing that among us? He's building his kingdom, not just in this room, but wherever he's placed you in this world. Let's pray. God, thank you for the love that you have shown to us. You didn't just demonstrate it from a distance. You didn't just tell us about it. But you entered into our world and served us, showed us what it means to be a servant, and made it possible for us to live in that same way. So thank you, God, that you have not left us alone in this. And thank you that it's not dependent on us to build your kingdom. Thank you that you are building your kingdom. Thank you that we serve a God who is powerful and strong and at work in this world, drawing people to yourself, redeeming, restoring, healing. And thank you that you've given us the chance to be a part of that, to be a part of the kingdom that you're building. May we draw close to you so that we can become all that you desire us to be in our hearts and in our actions everywhere we go. In Jesus' name, amen.